Hi, I'm Christina Orlova, host of the OCD Whisperer podcast. As someone who lives with OCD, I understand the struggles firsthand. If you're here, you're not alone. Before we start, grab your free OCD survival kit at www.coreresults.com to help you take control. That's K-O-R-results.com. Now let's dive into today's episode. Welcome to OCD Whisperer Podcast. Today with me, I have Crystal Propes, who's a wife and mother of three. She has OCD, emetophobia, ADHD, and PTSD, and she loves advocating for these disorders and connecting with others. Welcome to the show.
So glad to be here.
I know that you and I had reached out, and we were talking about especially emetophobia. And I definitely know a lot of folks, you know, when they're dealing with OCD, can have other things going on as well. So emetophobia does come up quite often. I just would love to hear your story. And how did all this start? How did you figure out, like, okay, what do I need to do about this?
So I was extremely young. I think I have been emetophobic. Like, it's literally for as long as I can remember. But if I think back into like the deep recesses of my mind, I had to have surgery on my elbow when I was five. And I was already freaking out about the anesthesia maybe making me nauseous at five. So it definitely appeared as early as four, maybe three. And so, yeah, I was very young. Emetophobia was really like my first manifestation of OCD. Like, I had the phobia part, but then like I obviously had like OCD tendencies going along with it. And I didn't know what it was called for a very long time. I think I was probably a teenager before I figured out that it was called emetophobia and I wasn't the only person who had this. And that there were other people out there like me. And I had like a lot of OCD stuff going on, OCD onset, like pretty close to the same time with other themes. And so I had a lot of OCD stuff going on like throughout my childhood. And as I was a teenager too, I think like when I was very little, there was the emetophobia. And then there was a lot of just right-esque compulsions where I would just get very anxious if things didn't feel a certain way when I was doing them. And then at 12 years old, my brain like broke and I had severe health OCD. And that was the first time I like really was like, I'm losing my There's like this dichotomy of like emetophobia where it like lived by itself in its little phobia area. And then OCD that lived with this whole other monster. And they didn't really connect much. I surprisingly did not have contamination issues, which was shocking until I had children and then they went to school. And then they started bringing home every germ known to man. And that is when my OCD actually like really latched onto my emetophobia and like gave me like true like contamination OCD, but only related to stomach illnesses. Like, I figured out it was OCD, I think around 18, but I didn't seek therapy for it until I was like 31 and like losing my mind about contamination issues. And so, that's where my PTSD.
That's interesting though. Like, so what happened there, right? Because I mean, anybody listening and following the show, most people have, I'm going to hope her that it's true from the time you find or you think you have OCD to the time that you actually get treatment. On average, it can be like 15, 16, 17 years, something like that. So you, here's an example where like, yeah, at 18, I kind of figured out this is what it is, but I didn't really do anything about it until later. So can you share with us what that gap was about?
Yeah, actually, it's pretty interesting. So the way I figured it out, this is ridiculous, but I had been like misdiagnosed with generalized anxiety. I used to work in the library in college, right? I was a freshman and I was sitting in the library and I was so bored because no one was in there. So I was reading the DSM for fun. And I got to the diagnostic criteria for OCD and I was like, oh, this is what is wrong with me. This is not anxiety. This is OCD. And like, it was like a whole world had been opened up to me. And I told my mom, I was like, Mom, I think I have OCD. And my mom was like, no, OCD is like so debilitating. And they do compulsions all day, every day. And I was like, no, Mom, compulsions can be mental. And like, that was the click there. I didn't have a ton of overt physical compulsions. I did have some, but I was pretty good at masking them. But I had so many mental compulsions. And until that day, I didn't realize that compulsions could be mental. And that was when everything clicked for me. College was really hard. I had severe health OCD. It like bounced between health, mental health. Like, I was terrified I was losing my mind. And then like severe religious OCD. I went to a Christian college and it like latched right onto that. And then I had pretty bad relationship OCD. Mm-hmm. I met my now husband then, and it bounced all around like crazy for like the entirety of college. And then shockingly, when I had kids, it kind of like chilled out. Being pregnant and nursing chilled my OCD out, which I know everybody doesn't have that experience, but I did. And so it was fairly quiet until I like got my cycle back from my youngest. And then like my hormones started doing things again and it blew up. Right around that time is when my kids started going to school. And so they started bringing home stomach bugs and it gave me PTSD. And there was this whole new, even though I already had OCD, there was this whole new OCD monster that was born out of the PTSD that was purely contamination and like all wrapped up in my phobia. So I've got these three different disorders, like torturing me, all wrapped up together. And that's when I decided like, okay, no, I need help. So that's when I sought treatment.
I see. So it's almost like if I got you right, is that it was still kind of livable and tolerable and kind of okay enough. And then it really kind of all collided in such a way that like, I can't maintain this.
Well, in college, it probably wasn't as tolerable as it seemed. Like I was pretty dang miserable and I should have sought treatment then, but I had to finish school. I didn't have time to like do therapy and like find a therapist and all this stuff. Yeah. So like it was pretty bad in college. And then, yeah, I had a big gap where it was like livable and tolerable. And then it was like, I have to take care of my family and I can't do that. So I need help. Like when there was other people depending on me and it wasn't just me, that's when it became like very clear that I needed treatment.
Got it. Yeah. So how did you find treatment?
So at first I started actually with NoCD. ERP was not a great fit for me. I'm not here to bash ERP. I'll say that as like a caveat, but it was just that I am exposed all the time anyways. And the thought of planning more exposure on top of that was just like something that like I physically was not capable of even like imagining because my OCD, there's a lot of people who have like, they don't tolerate distress well, and they are super avoiders, but like those weren't my issues. Like I was always distressed. If anything, I tolerated it too well. Like I didn't realize that I needed like help because I was just used to being distressed all the time. And I didn't really avoid things. I just did them anyways, terrified. So that's when I was talking to a friend. She was telling me about her experience with ICBT. And I was like, I think this could help me. And so she was at this point, she was in training to be a therapist herself. And she was part of a clinician's group for ICBT. And she posted in the clinician's group, I have a friend, is there anybody who takes this insurance who does ICBT? And luckily somebody was like, yes, this therapy center does. So I reached out to the specific therapy center that she recommended. And they got me in touch with a clinical psychologist there that does ICBT that took my insurance. And it was just like, all these things fell into place. And my therapist, like, so he went through the ICBT modules with me and just like, he's amazing. Like I couldn't have asked for a better fit.
That's awesome. So you feel like with that approach, yeah, it helps you kind of understand understand the OCD brain differently, because like you said, you're basically organically, like that's what we say in ERP kind of lingo, is like looking at organic or situational exposures, right? It's almost like if you choose to live a life of exposure, then you're always looking to move towards all those things, not avoid them. But you're like, well, I was definitely not avoiding them because they're kids, they're there, like I have to take care of them.
Yeah, so
there's no way I can, I mean, again, right? Everybody's different. Like some parents sometimes say that they have a hard time interacting with their kid because of OCD. But you still have to do something. So you really can't 100% just completely avoid the situation. So you're like, look, I'm there. That's not the thing. There's something else going on and I don't know how to address this. Okay.
Correct.
So let's fast forward. So you went through the different modules. Sounds like, you know, you got the concepts and you were applying them and you learned something different for yourself. What was the piece that you got out of ICBT that was different or that helped you break the cycle?
So module 8 was like life changing for me. So like the whole like reality sensing module, it was like this whole game changer, like, oh my gosh, I can just be present. It like says, like, if you're doing this, you're not actually present. It's like me, I spent all this time thinking I was being more present because I was like staring at my children and like monitoring them. But what it showed me is like, that is not using my senses normally. And so like that module taught me like how to use my senses normally, which I don't know that I had ever done in my life. When it came to OCD, like obviously I knew how to do it like outside of OCD. And then the other thing that really helped me was module 9. So 8 and 9 together, the alternative story, I was like, wait, I can just like believe reality. I don't have to like dig into this crazy story that my brain is like making up. And it just like practicing that observing reality and then just like believing things at face value instead of like creating a scary story out of it. It sounds so crazy, like when you just say it, but like really like practicing that and doing the daily exercises that come with those modules, all of a sudden I just like started believing reality and like stopped making obsessional stories out of something. And it happened very gradually just from like doing the practices. Those were the two like concepts from ICBT that like changed my life. But the other thing, and this isn't directly in ICBT, but it is pretty close in his new Resolving OCD book. My therapist had me do thought chains. I would tell him like, look, I keep trying to reality sense, but this was with module 7, like before we got to 8, I was like, but I can't, the whole bridge thing where you're supposed to like imagine yourself, I would like forget the bridge. I would just like fly into the bubble. And I was like, I don't know how to slow down. So what he told me to do is like, think back to my ruminations. When I realized I was ruminating, like go step by step until I get to the point where like I entered my imagination. Mm-hmm. And tracing backwards, and like I had to do it like in the evenings at night for a while before I could start doing it in real time. But tracing backwards made me realize like how deep I had gotten into the bubble before I ever realized I was in it. And like once I started recognizing like the language that my brain was using to pull me into it, I could stop it instead of following it in there. And his new book actually like does sequencing backwards. So when it teaches like what's in module 1, the obsessional sequence, it starts with the compulsion and has you go back to the trigger in that book. And that's like essentially what I was doing with the thought change. So that was also like instrumental to stop. Like I went from ruminating almost 24/7 to almost never ruminating at all. And that was like my worst compulsion. And so it's just amazing that I like can exist in reality and I don't spend all my time stuck in my head anymore.
I'll be honest. So like, obviously as a therapist and somebody who has OCD, and I have also learned ICBT and been applying it. So like, I understand as we're talking, but I'm also thinking about, you know, people listening who, you know, perhaps have not done it, have not heard of it.
Yeah.
When we're saying things like this, you know, it's pretty common to hear questions like, but how can you doubt when you do have a sensation? Like if it's, you know, that nausea, or what if I do throw up, right, or what if I do get sick, right? Because that is tied to quote unquote reality and having some sort of a feeling. Right. So what would you say to that?
Basically, it's like, that's the one thing where emetophobia is like, sometimes I do have reasonable doubt. And in those cases, ICBT doesn't help much. But like 99 times out of 100, what I'm worried about is not reality. It's not what's happening. So what we did, and again, this is like ICBT adjacent, but it was like, basically ask yourself, what direct evidence would I need for this doubt to be reasonable? And like, so for instance, for me, it's like, I have been directly exposed to a stomach virus. Like if I don't have any evidence that I have been, like one of my kids haven't been sick or somebody I've been around hasn't been sick, then I can't conclude that that weird feeling in my stomach is a stomach bug. You know what I mean? And so I like kind of stick to that. And drawing those like hard lines for what constitutes direct evidence for a reasonable doubt has been like instrumental in me like not catastrophizing like random normal scenarios. And it even works like with my kids, you know, because like people will say like, well, I mean, kids get sick all the time. It's like, yeah, but unless one of my kids has actually physically gotten sick, then I can't conclude that they have a stomach bug. Does that like, that's what helped me like the most in that situation. Now I will say, I'm not perfect. I am still emetophobic. If somebody in my house has a stomach bug, I'm a disaster. I have not figured out how to deal with that. And I don't know that I ever will. I've done a little acceptance there. It's like, I will probably always be emetophobic. It will never be easy if there's a stomach bug in my house. And I've just kind of had to like accept that. We're working on things that can help with like avoidance when I'm like out in public. Like I still do things, but I white knuckle, which is not great. So we're like kind of working on that. But again, like I haven't found a magic solution to dealing with realistic doubt when it comes to the emetophobia. I will say that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there isn't a magical solution. I think as humans, we don't do a good job understanding that whatever therapy you do, life is also still life, and life is still going to
right.
Things show up and things are going to happen. And there's no magical way that it's always going to be all happy and wonderful all the time. I mean, like I have a fear of heights, and you know, like when I first learned ERP, okay, I started going on purpose to more heights and more things just to kind of not be as distressed or avoidant of things. But at the same time, I recognize like, look, I get vertigo literally as things spin, things in a way that just, you know, I'm like, okay, that's just a thing I have. And the reality is, like, I think part of it is also evaluating how much of it really is getting in the way of my life or my joy, right? How much is it really impacting? Because if it's in a way where I can't do things I want, yeah, let's talk about that. But if it's like, well, I can still live a pretty reasonable and happy life, that can be okay too.
I don't need to climb Mount Everest to like live a happy life. That's something I've worked on actually a ton in therapy lately, is like the line between treating everything and then just like, I can live with this. You know what I mean? So like, that's the point. Like basically I didn't want to make myself miserable whenever it wasn't in my house. And I had to realize that like, I get through it if it's in my house, even though it sucks. And so as long as I'm not, you know, thinking about it when it's not in my house, that was like my goal. Like, I don't want to be worrying about this if it's not actually happening. And I feel like I'm not all the way there. Like, obviously it still worries me sometimes, especially if it's like, I'm hearing about it being like around in the community, but I'm like loads better than I was, which has been, you know, instrumental in me being like present with my children. So like, yeah, that I love that fear of heights analogy. It's, I will probably never be somebody who, like, if you've been sick, I'm not going to be your caretaker. So sorry, unless you're my child, but I think I can live with that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and exactly. I think at the end of the day, that's what we have to come down to. And like you said, acceptance, right? Accept what and where is kind of a personal boundary and a line. And then that's okay to have.
Right.
And that's very different though than, you know, if everything is driven by that obsessional process where you're literally now avoiding everything for a whole different reason. Yeah.
Right. It's like, allow me to like, I can go into my kids' school, even though I don't love it. You know what I mean? So I'm not avoiding that because of my fear. Like, I'm like going on my kids' field trips again. I don't love it, but I can do it. So like the things that like scared me, I'm not letting my phobia like control that. I didn't control me having children. Lots of emetophobic people are terrified to have children, but I still had kids. So I feel like maintaining some boundaries, like, okay, if you've had a bug, I'm not going to see you for 2 weeks. I think that that's like reasonable. It's reasonable to not want my family to be ill.
Well, let's switch gears for a minute, because you also said that you have ADHD. And so
I do.
You know, I do want to kind of ask, like, what is it like having both OCD and ADHD? Like, what do you notice at this intersection?
I love this question because I get it a lot. And it's like, how do you know which is OCD and which is ADHD? And it's like, it's very clear to me. I think maybe because I've done a lot of therapy, but like OCD is like always fueled by fear, always fueled by anxiety and doubt. And there's some like something I'm worrying about, right? ADHD is just like intrinsic. It's like, this is who you are. There is no like anxiety fueling it. For instance, what I noticed was I had treated my OCD and I wasn't ruminating all the time anymore, but I still couldn't relax. And I was like, why can I not relax? And that's when my therapist was like, you might should explore an ADHD diagnosis, because I have this like inability to just sit there. It's like my brain is screaming at me a million miles an hour. You need to get up and do something. You're just sitting here. And there's like my distraction, you know, like you can get like be stuck in your head with OCD. And there is like a type of inattentiveness that comes with being like stuck in your head. But then when I wasn't ruminating and I finally had like fought my way out of the OCD hole, I like was still having issues. Like, for instance, everything in my life has a routine, because if I deviate from that routine at all, everything will fall apart. I forget everything. So like one day my kid has scoliosis. I had to take her to Shriners, right? Ryan had driven my car that day, so the keys were already in the car. I forgot my whole purse, because the keys are usually in the purse. So if the keys are already in the car, then I don't need to grab the keys. And the fact that I even had a purse or needed a purse or needed my ID, I just didn't even remember. And I do stuff like that all the time. Anytime anything changes, everything gets forgotten. So like ADHD is a whole different monster from OCD, but it's like OCD is always fear. And ADHD is just this annoying thing that makes me like not functioning properly. Like I forget things. There's little doom piles all over my house of like, because I just don't have like if it takes like a bunch of mental effort, like I have to figure out where each individual piece of this pile goes, like that's too much mental effort. So it's like it just gets shoved in
that's
the corner.
Hilarious. Yeah. If anybody hears doom piles, what that really means is that like all around the house you'll have different pockets of things, like unfinished projects, like a box of books, some clothes with something else that you were working on, you're supposed to do, and then you're like, I'll get to it in a minute, and then suddenly they're all over.
Right.
Because ADHD, from my understanding, a lot of it is that executive functioning. So all the things that are typically easy for folks in terms of like scheduling, remembering, planning, and so on, you know, folks with ADHD, especially if there's some inattentive or that more hyperness, it just depends. But yeah, some of those pieces are not as easy, and it's not on purpose or intentional at all. It just literally leaves your mind so rapidly that in this case, like when you have a routine or like having a list or something, some way to help yourself remember is really helpful versus in OCD, if you're doing those things because of this fear that if I don't do it this way, my day and life will fall apart, completely different process.
Right. It's like, if I don't keep myself on track, nothing's going to work. It's not that I'm in a place of fear at all. And the other thing I wanted to say about my ADHD is I have combined types. So I have inattentive and hyperactive, but all of my hyperactive symptoms, it's almost exclusively verbal. So I have like this terrible habit of finishing people's sentences, cutting people off. It's very hard for me to wait my turn. Like you probably all see me, like you'll say something and I want to answer it and I'll have to like control myself. It takes extreme conscious effort for me not to interrupt people. So I come across often sometimes as like things that people perceive as rude, but that is like literally never my intention. And my whole life I've struggled with this and I like didn't realize that that was like a manifestation of ADHD until I was evaluated for it. And I was like, oh, this makes so much sense. But it was just funny when the ADHD evaluator, the clinical psychologist that evaluated me, she was like, all of your hyperactivity is verbal. And I was like, yeah, they used to make fun of me for that when I was a child for how much I talked. So I totally get it.
I love it. Oh my God. Thank you so much for coming on the show. This is a fun, fun conversation to have. Well, let me ask you, if people want to find you, how can they find you?
So my Instagram is at functionallyOCD. That's usually where I am. And there's like a message link on there, an email link on there. And then obviously I post as often as I can. You'll see educational stuff, real life stuff. And yeah, but this was super fun. And thank you so much for having me today.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the OCD Whisperer podcast. Remember, freedom from OCD is a journey and you're not alone. Visit www.coraresults.com to explore self-help masterclasses like Sneaky Rituals with Jenna Overbow or iCBT Masterclass with Christina Inabe. Don't forget to grab your OCD CBT Journal tracker and planner while you're there. If you found this episode helpful, please subscribe, share, and leave a 5-star review to help others find the podcast. Together, we can make a difference. Keep going, and I'll see you in the next episode.